Welcome to Trent Voices, the Trent University Alumni Affairs Show on Trent Radio. I'm your host, Donald Fraser of Alumni Affairs. It is Friday, August the 5th, and this is episode 42. Today's guest is joining us by Skype, as are most of our summer season guests. She's also the very first of our summer literary series, a string of podcasts that will include some of the who's who of Canadian literature. On the list, how about Man Booker Prize-winning author Yann Martell, suspense and mystery master, number one best-selling author Linwood Barclay, we have Trillium Book Prize finalist Jeanette Platana, and both Giller and Governor General Prize winner Richard B. Wright. But enough about our other guests. The kickoff to our literary series is none other than Leah McLaren, columnist for the Globe and Mail and Maclean's, frequent contributor to Toronto Life and The Spectator in England. She's also a novelist with two wonderful books under her belt, The Continuity Girl and A Better Man. As far as writers go, she's truly a busy one. Leah, welcome to Trent Voices.
Hello.
And welcome back to Canada.
Yes, thank you.
When did you get in?
The day before yesterday.
So you've just managed to sneak in that wonderfully hallowed, totally historic Ontario tradition, the creatively named Civic Holiday Long Weekend.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it all is a bit meaningless to me because I spend a lot of time working for Canadian publications in Britain, so I don't really get, I have to work through all of the long weekends there, and then I also completely forget about long weekends in Canada because it's never a long weekend where I am. So it's nice to actually be in Canada on a long weekend and to relax.
Yeah, now you're well known as a Canadian journalist and a Canadian columnist, but you actually live in London, and those who read your regular outpost in Maclean's or read your stuff in The Spectator in London know that, but how did you end up living in England?
Well, it's a long relationship I've had with London. The first reason why I went there was the Globe and Mail sent me over there in sort of just after 9/11 in early 2002, and nothing to do with 9/11. That was just when I went, and I went over there and I did a bunch of arts coverage and feature writing for them for about a year and a half, and then I came back, and then I was in a relationship with someone who was in London, a Canadian who lived in London, and we were sort of long distance for a couple of years, and then finally I moved over there. I decided to go freelance, and I moved over there to be with him and continue to write my column and start to do a bit more sort of foreign correspondent work for Maclean's, and then I just stayed, and that relationship didn't last, but then I ended up meeting my husband, who is British, and so that was that. And that's my life. I'm still back sort of often, about four times a year. It used to be four times a year. It's getting a little bit less as the children pile up, but and I work for a lot of Canadian publications, so my career in many ways is still Canada-centered, but it is international as well. So it's been nice. I find it's a kind of career that couldn't really have existed like 20 years ago. It really totally depends on technologies like Skype and obviously email and all of that. I've been fortunate in that sense.
Now, we bring up your work with Maclean's and your foreign correspondence work, and it's really interesting. It's a far cry from what you were doing with your very early work in the Globe and Mail, with columns like the Generation Y column, which arguably made you one of the most known, if not renowned, columnists in Canada. From the outset, your writing was a lot different than that of the old guard of Canadian columnists, particularly for a publication that saw itself as venerable. It really was the old guard of Canadian journalism. Your column was personal, or appeared to be personal. It appeared to be confessional. It was just as often as much about the columnist as it was about the subject of the column. And like I said, this was new ground for journalism in a traditional old Canada. How did this come about?
That column Oh, God. Well, yeah, in a weirdly haphazard way. I was a summer student at the Globe, and like an intern, and after university. And I was very fortunate to, you know, get that. The National Post launched the summer after I graduated from Trent. And so, you know, it's kind of unimaginable now, but there couldn't have been a better time, a more fortunate time to want to go into journalism than the, you know, the September after the September that the National Post actually launched. So suddenly there was just this plethora of jobs and a real search. There was a real search for young people and young talent. Because after the 90s recession, you know, there'd been a lot of stagnation, a lot of attrition in the media world. And suddenly it was booming again. And so the Globe, I was interning there, and and I knew all these people who were getting hired right out of university at the Post in really interesting jobs. And they started a new column called the Fifth Column, which ran on the back page of the front section beside where the facts and arguments piece used to go. I'm not sure if
it was actually my favorite page of the Globe for you.
Really? You remember that?
Oh, yeah. I was a facts and argument guy. I mean,
it still exists. I don't know where they put it because I rarely see the print edition anymore. But they decided to have a column called the Fifth Column that was going to be written by five or six women through the week. And it was me. They asked me to be the young one because I was I was ridiculous. I was like 22 or something, but it was me, Heather Malik, who's now at the Star, Peggy Wente. I think that's where she started. Margaret Wente. That's where she started her then now venerable column. and who else? Elizabeth Nixon, this woman, Elizabeth Nixon. And Peggy wrote two columns and the rest of us just wrote one. We each had a day of the week. Oh, Jan Wong had a day too.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So it really launched like quite a few careers of columnists who are now, you know, pretty well known. And almost all those women, I don't think Elizabeth Nixon is a columnist anymore, but the rest of us are all still writing and I was ridiculously young, but I sort of seized the opportunity, I like to think, and I wrote a series of columns about an escaped convict called Ty Conn. I started off writing more off the news, like it was not just all about me, but I cultivated a voice. I wrote a series of columns about this escaped convict, sort of cheering him on, and because he was a victim of circumstance in many ways, and then that story blew up and he ended up in a police standoff and he ended up killing himself. And the Fifth Estate did a big story on it. And, you know, Lyndon McIntyre was on the story. And I sort of owned the story for the Globe as a columnist. And that's one of the things you want to do as a columnist. You want to find your issues, find your arguments, and say the thing that a lot of people in a readership are maybe thinking, but nobody has quite said yet. You want to make that argument. And I think that's when a columnist is sort of at their best. So I had a fun year, and then they moved my column to the Saturday section, and then eventually to the Style section. And it was fun times. You know, it was my 20s, and the column became quite humorous, and it was what they really wanted. My editors really wanted a slice of 20-something life. You'll find most newspapers now. Maybe not as much in Canada, but certainly in the UK where I live now, they have these, there's always a role for this 20-something young woman, girl about town, living her life, the sort of Holly-go-lightly Carrie Bradshaw columnist role. And I did that for a while. But it's a role that, you know, you can't do forever. And I certainly grew out of it. But it made me quite notorious for a while. Because some people were outraged and shocked that the Globe and Mail would carry such drivel.
I think it's funny because as individuals, we're impacted by the baggage of the generation that came before us, or the two generations that came before us. And, well, for you, To say that you challenged the old guard, or the old guard of journalism, or the old guard of readers, is to put it lightly. I look back on this time, and I remember that it seemed like everyone was reading Leah McLaren, and if they weren't reading Leah McLaren, they were talking about Leah McLaren, and these things could be mutually exclusive. A lot of people talked about Leah McLaren without actually reading Leah McLaren, and we'll go back in time for a minute and tell me a bit about how people were responding to this column.
Well, it was, you know, as you know, it wasn't all positive attention, but there was a lot of positive to it. It was strange. I think looking back on it now, it's very normal now because of social media for people to pop up and become sort of flashpoints overnight. And you know, people, that kind of exposure is not as strange an experience, but it was trying at times. But there, you know, but you can't. But you know, haters gonna hate. So
I have Taylor Swift back there to have your back.
I know, but it's looking back on it, there was a lot of sexism involved, and also a lot of, in Canada, there's a lot of tall poppy syndrome. But at the same time, I had a blast. I mean, I was in my 20s, living in Toronto, running around to all the cocktail parties and just living my life and having a great time. And the Globe was flying me all over the place, and I was covering fashion shows and covering the film festival and going to Bosnia and doing like crazy assignments. And it was a real wonderful boom time, the last, you know, possibly like the last great, epically, it was the great era of newspapers. It was the end of the golden age in a way. So I find it hard to look back, as much as it was strange to be at this. There was a kind of perfect storm of attention. I just sort of look back at that time with so much nostalgia because it was just so much fun. And times are very different in the world of newspapers now. And there's a sense of everything tightening and shrinking and it becoming a kind of sunset industry, which is very difficult for people to cope with. So
I want to talk about the state of newspapers in a second, but first I want to talk about this transitional time of newspapers and your involvement. You kind of beat the internet to the punch. It's funny that your earlier column was called Generation Y, because the generation itself has become known for their inherent knowledge and their inherent use of social media, and for using the self as a point of reference. And this became not just the media norm, but really the day-to-day norm, first for a generation, Generation Y, and then for pretty much all of society. Do you see yourself as a harbinger for this direction of writing?
Well, not really. I mean, I guess what I was doing, I was just sort of writing in a way that felt sort of instinctive to me. A big thing for me was that I had not gone to journalism school, unlike a lot of the young graduates who were going into journalism at that time and now. So I'd never been told, nobody ever told me not to write about myself. No one ever told me that was shameful or bad, or that the story shouldn't be about you. And also, I'd come from theater school. That was my background. I went to a school for the performing arts, and then I did an English degree. So I wanted to almost like entertain as much as I wanted to expound about. And also, it's a weird thing to get a column at the age of 22. Like, I didn't really have fully formed politics or political opinions. I had some ideas. Like, I was well read. I was a bright kid, but you know, I couldn't pretend to be Jeffrey Simpson. I wasn't going to pretend to be something I wasn't. So there was that. I was just kind of winging it. And at that time, but it is true that, and at that time in Canadian media, people that age weren't given columns. It was just, a column was something you got after you spent a long time as a political reporter and worked your way up through the ranks. And then, you know, then you were given a column as a kind of cushy, like second, third stage of your career. So it was, so in that sense, it was pioneering. But yes, I think it is funny looking back at how supposedly controversial it was when now with social media, I mean, with the selfie generation, and I don't even think of it as generation Y, it's more the millennial generation has just made a complete art form of that. And the idea of becoming a kind of acting as though, becoming an entertainer becoming as much an entertainer as a person who writes and has opinions, combining those two things is now just completely what everyone does. It's not controversial at all. The idea of building your own brand and having your own voice today is just, that's just normal. That's what every teenager with a smartphone and an Instagram account is doing, right?
And interestingly, you've kind of gone in the opposite direction, because you wear a few journalistic hats. In the Globe and Mail, where you hold your longtime post, Leah still pops up as a point of reference, though you're just as likely to write about parenthood as you are to write about trendsetting friends. Jump over to Maclean's, and it's a whole different ballgame, where you are writing about serious politics. You're a foreign correspondent. It's a completely different gig. Tell me about how you view yourself as a columnist today, as compared to back then.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I have sort of expanded the range of things that I write about, and for Maclean's is such a great magazine, but it has a very there. I'm not a columnist really in Maclean's. I write a letter from Europe. And I might call it my column because it's a regular space, but the voice that I have there is very much the Maclean's voice, the news voice. It's not about me joking around with the reader and having that kind of a personal rapport. It's about me bringing a sort of dispatch from Europe each week or every other week to the magazine, an analysis of current events, of things like Brexit or whatever. So that is what's required there. And in the Globe, my column, which is now about parenting and relationships and women's issues a lot, so they do give me a very free rein. In that column, I have a very clear voice, which is a more humane voice, where I'm more open and personable, and I talk about my childhood and my kids, and it's just a bit more intimate. But I think the two things, I just see it as wearing different hats. And then I also write, I've written a couple of novels, and I'm doing a screenplay right now. I mean, every time, if you're a bit of a jack-of-all-trades writer, as I am, you just have to learn to wear different hats and have different voices, and it's just sort of part of doing what you do.
Okay, then, here's the question. What do you like to write most? You've got the foreign correspondence and politics thing. You've got opinion pieces. What floats your boat? What really gets you excited to put your fingers to keyboard?
Well, it depends. I'm pretty restless, so I do find I like to change it up, which is probably not the best. It's not the best thing for, you know, no agent ever wants to hear a writer say, I like to do everything, because they really just want you to say, I want to write best-selling works of medieval historical fiction. And they're like, great, we can package that. Let's go with that. Just don't do anything else. So, but right at the moment, I just have been working on an adaptation of my most recent novel, A Better Man, with a co-writer and a film production company in London, and it's been really, really fun. It's just I haven't done much in journalism and fiction writing. You don't get to do much co-writing, like writing with a partner, and it's just been really fun to do that. Not least because you don't have to do all the fucking writing, which is great. Somebody else does the work. Yeah, so I think it appeals to the lazy part of me. No, but it actually, it's really interesting screenwriting and learning about the architecture of story and all that kind of stuff. So
this
that's what
your first foray into screenwriting.
No, that's true. I wrote and developed a TV show that ended up being a TV movie for CBC a few years back. That was a British Canadian co-production. So I've done a bit of that, but I'd like to do more. And and maybe write more fiction. I'm 7 months pregnant at the moment, so I'm a little bit. I have more novels in me, but it's been slow going, and it will probably be slow going for the next few months on the next novel. But there will be another novel.
As a person who occupies a rather large piece of the journalistic spectrum. From lighter lifestyle pieces to culture pieces to opinion pieces to political analysis, you have an insider's view of journalism that's notable, both for its depth and its breadth. So I'm curious as to how you view the state of journalism today. The newspaper industry is facing massive, massive difficulties. Newsrooms are shrinking. Fewer people are being tasked with doing way, way more work than they used to. There's less time to give stories the care and the attention that's needed. At the same time, you have this BuzzFeedification of news, where sharing of content becomes more valued than the creation of content, and where story, where depth of story is constantly sacrificed in order to meet timeliness instead. How do you see the state of journalism today?
Oh God, that's a massive question.
I don't play softball.
When you say that sharing content has become more important than the content itself, I don't know if that can ever entirely be true. I like to think that there will always be a place for quality content. My main worry that's, you know, both a worry broadly speaking about our culture, but also actual burning worry in my life is who's going to pay for that content? So who's going to pay me to make that content? Because I'm certainly not going to make it for free and nobody else is. So that is, my husband's an editor at The Guardian in Britain. And it's a question that the two of us just talk about constantly is what's the next model going to be? How's it going to work? And nobody really knows. We do know that the online model, the idea that newspapers just need to go online and that will solve everyone's problem has not worked because what has happened there is that advertisers, digital advertising has not followed newspapers going online, and even when they have paywalls or porous paywalls, as we see with most newspapers in Canada, and the reason why the digital advertising hasn't really followed is that the social media giants like Facebook and Google and Twitter, etc., have sucked up a lot of the digital advertising, clearly because they have the information on the viewers, which, you know, and even though newspapers can try and get as many registered readers as they can, they can't really compete with something like Gmail. You know, Google Ads is just, it's just enormous. And so right now, what a lot of big media organizations and big newspapers are trying to do is build relationships with social media monoliths to sort of find a way to keep producing their content in a way that is shareable and worth something to the social media platforms. It's very complicated, but it seems like that is the only way forward. But it's tricky. It does make you wonder about whether the whole concept of a newspaper as we know it, as this wonderful creation with all sorts of different kinds of content like sports reporting and news reporting, foreign news coverage and comment and analysis and art stories and dance critics and opera critics, is it just what's the point of it anymore? Like, will it just fragment completely and become little niche hubs of people creating digital content for social media platforms? I mean, the idea, print is still, interestingly, most newspapers, the Globe and Mail included, and, you know, The Guardian, many of them still make the majority of their money from print sales. But that obviously is declining and eventually will just decline more and more. So there is a sense that eventually print will go the way of the dodo. And when that happens, what's the point of a newspaper? I mean, apart from the brand, obviously the name, the Globe and Mail, the name, the Guardian, the name, the New York Times, what it says to interested readers is, this material is fact-checked, this material is quality. But the actual package itself, like the websites, newspaper websites, which seem so new and interesting to us 5 years ago, are, many people are saying, are completely obsolete. Take them down. What's the point? What's the point? Nobody gets their news. Nobody goes to a web. Like, what 22-year-old, what listener to this podcast is going, I'm going to get some news from the Globe and Mail website? No. They might read lots of Globe and Mail articles, but they're reading them on Twitter and or on, you know, on Facebook, or, you know, they're getting them in a feed.
And so, yeah, you have the situation where print media sites are now acting as repositories, where things are pulled from these sites onto Facebook and onto Twitter. People are not hanging out at the Globe and Mail. They're not hanging out at Maclean's. They're getting these stories in fragmented pieces pulled from the individual sites, which means that the advertising revenue doesn't skew the same way that a traditional newspaper does, or the early online version of these newspapers did. So with less money coming in and fewer reporters being hired, I think a lot of young writers wonder, you know, how the heck do I get into this field? How do I break into this? And so with the changing media landscape, what advice do you have for young writers, alum, new grads who are trying to establish themselves or to kickstart a career?
Well, I mean, I don't know that my advice on that would have changed that much from when I was younger, in that if you want to be a published writer, you just have to pitch editors wherever editors are, and think up great story ideas, pitch them and try and write them and publish them, whether it's online or print, it doesn't really matter. But if you just keep doing that over and over again, eventually you'll sort of build up a name for yourself. I mean, one of the things you can do now that you always could do is, you know, go off if you are 22 and you have some time on your hands, you know, and you want to cover something, then go cover it. Don't go to Syria, but, you know, or Northern Iraq. Not, I'm not advising that, but, you know, you can go to where the heat is, go to the place that you're curious about and do a story and take a chance. And hopefully an editor will take a chance on you. I mean, there is also there are different publications too that are cropping up as the old beasts decline a little bit. And you see, and I've known a lot of young writers who've done really interesting stuff for BuzzFeed or for Vice. You know, there's always new stuff kicking down the door. So I think that young talent will always find a place. And also, of course, you can do your own thing. You can self-publish now. More people self-publish than ever before, or have their own platforms or their own blogs, much as I hate the word. You know, that there's no harm in doing that as well. And but there's no doubt that it's really competitive and it's really difficult. And a lot of people will tell you a lot of miserable stuff. But I don't think that it is a terrible time right but it's a time of great uncertainty and transition, which is never an easy time in any industry. But media is bigger than ever. People are reading more than they've ever read before. We live in such a highly literate and highly mediated society. I don't think there's any worry about media evaporating. It's just a question of what it's going to mean for content and what form it's going to take. It's so strange. Like my career, I'm 40 now, and I sort of started writing pieces about 20 years ago, and now it's just unrecognizable, the landscape that I'm in now compared to the one that I started in. And that's amazing. Like some of the newspapers in Britain, like the Globe is, I think, well over 150 years old. So for, basically a century and a half, nearly, everything just went along the same. Like we make a newspaper, we publish it the next day, we make a newspaper, we publish it the next day. Then this thing that called the internet came along and just completely blew it all apart in a space of a couple of decades. So it's quite wild. I feel simultaneously fortunate and slightly bereft to have chosen this line of work at this particular time. It's so interesting, but it's also pretty scary. I have a colleague who likened it to being like a milkman in 1956. Like you're going around with your little truck and you're delivering milk and you're thinking, yeah, I mean, there's fewer and fewer people wanting milk, but they still want milk. They just don't want it delivered the way I'm delivering it, right? But somebody's gonna want milk. Like, what's this gonna mean? I'm not gonna lose my job, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you it was a brand new job, and you were young. You were writing for the Globe at the age of 22, and this was the new normal for you, even if it wasn't the new normal for the people that were working at the Globe and Mail. But yeah, you're a recent graduate. School would have been a very recent memory for you. So how did it feel? How did it feel to have this responsibility and this kind of gig?
It's responsibility, but it's not that much responsibility that a writer in a newspaper bears. It's not like they said to me, you have to be like the news editor. Then I would have been totally fucked. I didn't actually have to like manage people or make decisions apart from having ideas. So in a sense, it was responsibility in the sense that it was a lot of attention, but it was, but I was very, I've been through theater school, so I loved attention. Star. I didn't mind the attention. So I was just quite happy to do that. And it was so, I just remember being sitting in story meetings at the Globe and Mail, and there were all these fantastic feature writers around, and some of whom are still there, many of whom have retired or some have died. And I was just like awestruck. Everybody was so intelligent and so cool and smart. And it was just a really electrifying place to be. And I just felt so, so lucky, which I was, I was super lucky. And I realized that it isn't that way for everyone. And in fact, like most of my friends from high school, they spent years like waiting on tables going back and doing extra degrees and trying to figure out what they want to do. That was the luckiest thing for me, was that I still just pinch myself, is that I kind of figured out what I wanted to do, broadly speaking, by the age of 22. And that is just, and I just loved it and I've never looked back. And that is the luckiest thing of all, because for a lot of people, there's a long searching period where they try teaching and then they don't like that. And then they try the law and they don't like that. And it's tough. It's just really tough. If you're a bright, creative, or even not creative person, to just find the right career path for yourself. And it's so important to find that, because it's such a huge, it's such a huge factor in personal happiness.
You mentioned the fact that your idea for your career was almost fully formed by the age of 22, which is really kind of the exit point of university, fresh on the heels of graduation. So I'm wondering how your time at Trent prepared you for really a shotgun start to a writing career.
I was a culture editor for The Arthur. Is The Arthur still around?
Arthur is still going strong.
Oh, good. That's great. Yeah, and we hosted the Cup Conference. I remember that when I was there, when I was in third year, I think. And I did some theater at Trent, and I just worked with some great professors who I did reading courses. I don't know if that's still available there, but I had the two professors I remember the most are Charmaine Eddy. Is she still there?
Yep.
She's so fantastic. She did like a one-on-one Faulkner reading course with me one summer, and I would meet her in cafes, or I'd go to her house and we'd just sit there and talk about Faulkner, go to her office, and it was just so cool. It was such an amazing experience I never could have had at a bigger university. That was the thing about Trent, was that you really could kind of, in many ways, kind of tailor your academic experience, because it wasn't like a great big degree granting machine, at least in the English department where I was. It was just really intimate, and there was just a small pool of incredibly talented, dedicated professors and great students. So it was wonderful in that sense. And I think it probably helped me in my career, in that I was very, I met the features editor from the Globe and Mail, who gave me my internship at an alumni weekend. Her name's Catherine Bradbury. She's now the editor in chief of Metro. You know, the giveaway. But she went on to be the features editor at the Globe and Mail, and she was my mentor. And she was married to they're now divorced, but her then husband, John Barber, who was a longtime columnist at the Globe, and Catherine was the features editor. And she gave me my first gig. So that was helpful. And she came out for an alumni weekend. And so I did a couple of years at McGill before I transferred to Trent. And when I was leaving McGill, I remember a couple of my McGill friends said, "Oh my God, you can't go to Trent. You won't make the connections that you're going to make at McGill." But actually, in fact, I made probably the single most important connection I ever made in my career through a Trent alumnist. So
she's wonderful.
You should really have her on the podcast or interview her, because she is such an amazing woman who has she's worked everywhere, and she's formidable and mentors at Metro. I mean, that's a place to go and try and do an internship. She just has, I've been in to visit her, and she just has this like small army of 22 to 28 year olds just running that place. And it's really, really cool thing to watch.
Totally. And they push out a huge amount of content and get into a huge audience each day. At the time, I remember it being very innovative. It was an innovative way to get news into people's hands, literally into people's hands, as they were entering subway stations and having this paper thrust into their hands. Okay. Your favorite, fondest Trent memory?
Let me think. What can I... Well, I was in a show. I wouldn't even call this memory fond, but it just makes me laugh to think. I was in a show written and directed by a guy called Josh Meisner. I have no idea where Josh Meisner is now, but he wrote this crazy play that we performed at the Union Theater. And it was sort of funded by bursaries from Theater Trent, which was a little organization. Like, we granted out the bursaries from the university had some cash, and we did this like insane play in the basement of Theater Trent, of the Union Theater. I have no idea if that still exists.
The Union, unfortunately, is not, although Hunter Street is still active as a
is it
kind of play, hangout place for the arts. Yeah,
that's good. Is the Only still there?
Yeah, you know what? I'm a regular at the Only. The patio is a thing of beauty. definitely come up. I'll host you. I'll buy you a beer at the Only. Well,
I would love that.
Once you've given birth, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. No, I love the Only, and I loved crazy art plays at the Union Theater. And oh my God, and what's the Pig's Ear and the Red Dog? Seeing Al Purdy, he came to read.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Did an amazing appearance at the Red Dog. That I think, was it Tim Etherington? Is he still around? I'm friends with him.
Yeah, Tim just put out a play with his daughter, who's, I guess, 12 years old. They hijacked a fairy tale, and I forget which one, and they put it on at a showcase in Peterborough, on the big stage in Peterborough. And so Tim is kicking around. He's still making plays. A lot of people who are part of that scene are still here. The Union is not, but there's a new theater on top of the Gordon Best Theater, where a lot of good stuff happens. There's great improv happening. You got to get your butt back here.
I know. That had just started, the Gordon Best Theater, when I was leaving, but it was always... It was really, really, there was an amazing art scene in Peterborough that was actually amazingly well integrated with the university culture. You know, often the university towns, there can be a real divide between them, but there was an amazing amount of people who would stick around, and which I didn't, but many people do. And I'm friends with this woman, Stephanie McMillan, who was very involved with the theater crowd at Trent, and she used to host. She was, for a brief time, she was a freegan. Do you know what that is? Freegans are like people who aren't just vegans. They just like to eat found food. So like fall. This is such a Trent thing, isn't it?
It is totally a Trent thing. I should point out that I am wearing Birkenstocks right now. Just so you know.
And she once hosted at the Union Theater a roadkill potluck. So people found roadkill and they ate like dead raccoons and stuff.
I think I remember that happening.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was amazing. Well, you only do that at Trent, right?
Well, you talk about our art scene and how incredible that is. But our writing scene is also truly incredible. The podcast that we're doing right now, this Literary Speakers, this literary series, features folks like Ian Martell, we have Linwood Barclay, Richard B. Wright, Jeanette Platana. There are awards and accolades falling from the sky on these alumni. It makes me wonder how you saw the writing scene when you were here at Trent.
Oh, it was really vibrant and great. My boyfriend at the time was Andrew Piper, and we lived together, and he was writer in residence in my last year at Trent, up at Champlain College. And so we had to host like all these visiting writers, and a little Scottish writer and her girlfriend came and stayed with us for like 3 weeks and stayed in our apartment with us for part of that time. And her name was Allie Smith. And I ran into Allie at the Bailey's Award last year, formerly the Orange Prize, which she won for the second time. She was someone who was like virtually unknown when she came and stayed and was a writer in residence at Trent. And so I mean, the English department there was really fostered a lot of great writing, and there were great workshops going on, and a lot of literary talent kind of burgeoning and bustling out of that campus, for sure.
We haven't really had time to delve into the other side of your work, and that's your fiction. Fiction is what most of our guests on this literary series will be focusing on. And with you, we really wanted to talk about the journalism side of writing. But you do have two novels, The Continuity Girl and A Better Man. How would you describe your fictional work to readers who only know you as a journalist?
They are entirely made up. They are truly fiction, works of fiction, and The Continuity Girl. They're both novels, sort of based in reality, that at the same time have, I hope, pretty satisfying plots. But they're about relationships, and The Continuity Girl is about a young woman who's desperate to have a baby, who sort of goes on a quest to find a sperm donor for her baby, and the A Better Man is about a marriage. It's about a man who sort of wants out of his marriage, and decides that the best way to get the best sort of divorce settlement from his wife is to pretend to be the man that she wants him to be, in order to kind of woo her into being less angry at him and being more independent, and then he will divorce her and get a better divorce settlement. So, and he ends up kind of turning into this great husband that he's really just trying to cynically pretend to be. So it's about the way the mask can become the face, and if you fake it to make it, are you actually, is that as good as the real thing? So yeah, that's what my fiction is about. It's I think in terms of, you know, I don't know if readers of my column would probably be interested to read my novels. The political coverage is it would read kind of like a completely different writer, I'm sure.
I think that the tone of your opinion pieces and your personal pieces, they resonate through your fictional work. And we should definitely plug A Better Man, because it's going to be released very soon in paperback. So look for that. Leah, we're out of time. In fact, we went over time.
You had so much fun. So many good things to say.
It's been fun. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, welcome back to Canada. Enjoy it while you're here. And thanks for being on Trent Voices today.
Thank you for having me, Donald. I appreciate it.
And once again, this has been Trent Voices. I'm your host, Donald Fraser. We've been talking to journalist and author Leah McLaren. Don't forget to join us in 2 weeks' time when we will be talking to the incomparable Yann Martell. We'll see you then. But in the meantime, don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at the Trent University Alumni Association page. You can find us on Twitter at Trent Alumni, on Instagram at Trent_Alumni, and on LinkedIn at the official Trent University Alumni Association page. Folks, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much, and we'll see you again next week.